Hello and welcome to 10x9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Doran, and this is the 10x9 podcast. We had a truly amazing night this week in Belfast's Black Box, a full house, and the place was buzzing. There were more story submissions than ever, which was great, but it also meant I had to email some people in advance looking for volunteers to withdraw. And being 10x9ers, of course, enough of them agreed. We also had 3 first-timers, 2 of whom you'll hear on this podcast, with their stories on the theme, night.
I stared at the underside of my car, looking for anything out of place or unusual. It's a bit late now, I was thinking, as I awkwardly got up, looking around to make sure no one had seen me.
Giggling our heads off at the likes of Billy Big Nose, who used to ride the buses eating raw mints out of a carrier bag. We were living love's young dream.
Ben's in surgery and somebody needs to be there when it's over. Why is Ben in surgery? His balls hurt.
So, security concerns, a teenage tragedy, and a testicular trauma. That's all to come, but just before that, I'd like to give you a flavour of our live events, so let me explain. I write a short upsum of each story for the end of the evening, which you don't hear in the podcast, as it wouldn't make sense. Otherwise, everything I say just comes out of my head, which explains a lot. But sometimes, that can have its downsides.
The only part of this evening that I actually script is at the very end, when I do a wee little upsum of the stories. And I actually, writing that out, and I thought, something popped into my head. I thought, that's a great joke. And then I thought, I'm not going to waste it on the end of the evening. I'm going to put it at the start of the evening. But because I don't have a script, there was nowhere to put it. And I thought, no, it's so good, you will not forget that joke. I completely forgot the joke. So if it comes back to me, and you know what? It was probably crap anyway. What? Yeah, that's right. That's ageism. You're right.
It could well be old age indeed, as regular 10x9er Lila kindly pointed out. Oh well, let's get on with it. Our first story comes from one of those first-timers I mentioned. There are 2 F-bombs used very appropriately. Let me introduce Chris Stother.
I struggled out of the front door, a large sports bag over my right shoulder and another under my left arm. The salt air filled my nostrils as I clumsily stepped outside into the cold morning air, the silence broken only by the chirps and calls of the dawn chorus. My car was parked directly outside on the small country road, which was poorly lit by the orange glow of the phosphorus streetlights, a slight hint of daylight barely visible on the horizon, threatening the darkness. I've been living in my grandparents' old house for several months now. It was a mid-terrace house, which sat right on the coast, only a single track road separating it from the sandy beach. It had only a small front yard, approximately a metre deep, but this was made up by the massive long garden at the rear, which seemed to go on forever. I'd spent much of my childhood exploring it. Although I had hardly closed my eyes all night, I was wide awake and alert, nervous but excited, and had spent most of the previous hours staring at my alarm clock, petrified of sleeping in. I put both of the bags into the car, the large one thrown into the back seat, and the smaller bag gently placed into the passenger footwell. The tide was fully in. Although I couldn't see it in the darkness, I knew the sound so well as I listened as the waves gently rolled over the sand, only metres from where I was frantically running back and forth from the car to the house, double-checking at everything I needed. I shut the front door before jumping into the driver's seat and taking a breath. Starting the car, I set off, beginning my journey to North Belfast. As I travelled around 100 metres along the road, it hit me, fuck, as the panic set in. I gently brought the car to a stop in the middle of the road before jumping out and dropping to my knees beside the driver's door. I stared at the underside of my car, looking for anything out of place or unusual. It's a bit late now, I was thinking, as I awkwardly got up, looking around to make sure no one had seen me. I needn't have worried, though, as it was 5 o'clock on a winter's morning in Clocky, the sleepy seaside village of the Ards Peninsula. Not a light to be seen in any of the houses that I passed. I was disappointed in myself. for not checking the car before I had even touched it. What if there had been a bomb underneath? What would people think? He could blow up on his first day, fucking idiot, didn't check the car. Back then I was full of irrational thoughts like this, more concerned with what people thought than what actually matters. The harsh reality is, if there had been a device under my car that morning, I'd be dead or seriously sore. Hundreds of thoughts went through my mind as I travelled to work that morning. I was so nervous and excited at the same time. Would people like me? Would I be accepted? Was it as bad as everyone made out? And so on and so on. At 21 and fresh out of the police training college, I'd learned all about criminal law, tactical patrolling, personal safety. But in hindsight, my real education in policing was only beginning. I thought that I could take on the world, hearing stories from others what policing in North Belfast would be like, how tough it was, and some of the sights I might see. I was eager to get stuck in. I was eager to prove myself. As I drove along the Ards Peninsula and through the villages on my way to the city, I hardly passed a single car. Soon the dark country roads were exchanged for bright amber glow of streetlights as I moved closer and closer to Belfast. I began to see more traffic on the road, paying closer attention to every car I passed, growing more cautious. A heightened sense of vigilance came over me the closer to Belfast I got. Of course, I had made that journey thousands of times before. This time it was different. This time I was going to police the streets of one of the toughest areas in the city. An area deeply divided with many sectarian interfaces, scenes of regular civil disorder and terrorist threat. At 21 years of age, it was a massive responsibility, and I definitely did not appreciate the gravity of what I had just undertaken. Nor did I have the maturity to fully understand the risks involved or impact it would have on every aspect of my life. Policing anywhere in the world is not a 9-to-5 job, but especially in Northern Ireland. The job and the risks associated with doing it are not confined to the workday. We could not take the thread off and hang it in our locker with the uniform. We had to wear it every day, everywhere, at all times, at home, with friends, even in our sleep. I drove along the motorway, breaking off into the north of the city and along the Crumlin Road. I noticed a police Land Rover parked on the footpath. A heavy-set police officer standing at the rear wearing black body armour and a machine gun slung around his chest, both hands firmly gripping the weapon. His top button was undone, a black clip-on tie clipped to one side of his collar. I could feel his eyes pierce my skin as he stared into my car as I passed, looking for the slightest thing out of place. I thought to myself, what's going on? I nervously nodded at him as if to say, I'm one of you. But his gaze never broke. The expression on his face never changed. I can honestly say I was shitting myself. I would soon learn that this was a daily occurrence, and one which would be taken very seriously by all of the station party. Get out and cover the changeover would be the sergeant's morning cry. I carried on along the Crumlin Road before breaking left into Tennant Street. I noticed another Land Rover parked at the footpath opposite the junction. Despite only having travelled 30 miles that morning, I felt as if I was a million miles from the sedate seaside village I called home. I pulled into the heavily fortified station entrance, winding my window down and holding my warrant card proudly, presenting it to the heavy armoured window of the Sanger, waiting for the window to open and someone to greet me. However, this wasn't to be. I could barely make out the outline of someone as they glared out towards me, the barrier beginning to lift. No, oh, you must be Chris. Welcome to Tennant Street. Just a silent raising of a barrier invited me inside. I drove forward, passing Land Rovers parked in the front yard, many of them bearing scorch marks and scars of what I assumed to be previous outings. Eventually, finding a parking space in the back car park, I took a breath, thinking to myself, okay, let's do this. Now, as nervous as I think I'd ever been in my life until right now, but excited about what was to be, I got out of the car and struggled with my kit bag. Throwing it over my shoulder, I began to make my way towards the rear station door. As I tentatively walked, I heard the murmur of a car engine slowly getting louder. Headlights of a car began to light the path in front of me as it slowly travelled in my direction. A dark Audi A4 slowed to a stop the passenger window already down. A voice coming from inside. "All right, kid, you must be Chris. I'll be on in there, I'll see you in the locker room." And then it drove away, deeper into the car park and into the darkness. The window sliding closed as it went. I didn't even see who was inside. But I didn't care. Finally a friendly voice. A welcome of sorts. Suddenly I felt slightly at ease. As I do know just now. Thank you.
Chris, thank you so much. A reminder of the bad old days here, but what a great story and a great 10x9 debut. Come back soon. As I'm always reminding you, 10x9 is constantly in need of storytellers. Okay, maybe not this month, but generally. Whether you're new like Chris or returning to the 10x9 mic, get in touch at our website. Whether it's just a vague idea or a fully formed epic. And if you're a bit nervous, shy or reluctant, remember you're the people 10x9 was created for. Okay, on to our next story, and it's our second first-timer. She'd been coming to 10x9 for years and finally got up the nerve to tell this. Here's Siobhan McGuigan.
One night in March 1988 changed my life forever. I'd been going out with a guy called Mickey Rogers for about 2 years. I was 18, going on 19, in my A-level year at school. And he was 19, about to turn 20 that coming August. He was funny and gorgeous and was a supervisor and top man, which to me then was the pinnacle of success. For anyone who remembers it, top man was then beside where the Big Boots is in town now. Top man was upstairs. I'd head into town after school with my mates in my stunning school uniform of green pinafore and brown socks. Stunning not in a good way. Heading up that escalator to see him, leading my mates, I felt so cool. He'd come sauntering over, usually in his own stunning outfit that usually had a shimmer to it, maybe a shiny suit, or those trousers with 1,000 pleats. He looked like the band A Flock of Seagulls had booked on him, if you remember them. I'd wait for him after work and we'd head home together to Glengormley on the bus, negotiating the ring of steel barriers around the city and the army's searches, giggling our heads off at the likes of Billy Big Nose, who used to ride the buses eating raw mince out of a carrier bag. We were living love's young dream. We fell out all the time. We'd split up for a few weeks, then come across each other in the Lansdowne or Joplin's with someone else and spend the night eyeing each other up or trying to make the other jealous, which usually worked. We'd often have a sneaky snog when our new partners weren't about or get together again a few days later swearing we'd stop being so stupid because all we wanted was each other. We were simply drawn to each other even at that young age. One of the best nights together that I remember is so, so simple. We bought a quarter bottle of vodka, 2 tins of Coke, and sat on a curb, pouring away half the tins of Coke so we'd have room to pour in an equal share each of the vodka. I remember laughing our heads off at nothing. We were good kids, really. Public drinking was the height of our delinquency at that stage. In a strange turn of events, that curb that we sat on is right across the road from my current house. I walk my dog Gino past that spot most days. We had another fallout at my school formal in early 1988. So a few weeks later, when we made up as usual, we decided to keep quiet that we were back together. We were no poison packs, but people knew us. Mickey had a real job, wore shiny clothes, and had a flat top. He was someone in our teenage world. Roll on to the end of February 1988, when we'd been back together again a few weeks. Mickey drove his dad's car to see me and parked up, again oddly, literally within sight of where I now live. That night, we talked about how we had to stop this nonsense. We were open about how we felt about each other, and the words getting engaged were used. I totally get that we were young. But we were both tired of messing each other about and it just felt like we had a destiny together. The morning after that, at the start of March 1988, I was woken up by the front door being banged about 7 a.m. I heard my dad go to answer it as my mum was already away to work in Truffle's restaurant beside the city hall above the spinning wheel, if you remember that. I remember Daddy calling me downstairs. I remember coming downstairs really confused about what was going on. Mickey's brother Martin was at the door. He was there to tell me that Mickey had been killed in a car crash the previous night, along with another of our mates, also called Mickey. Mickey Bradley, a guy with a huge smile and infectious laugh. I threw clothes on me, and the next few days were a blur of being in his family home at the wake, with the closed coffin in the front room where I lay in his bed at night just to be in his space. And his folks totally treated me like part of the family. We all then had to find our way through the funeral and to a life out the other side. We were a really close bunch of mates. We'd lost two friends, remember? A totally horrific experience so young. In the true style of our gang, even the funeral couldn't go without incident, as one mate accidentally crashed his car into another mate's in the funeral cortege. For years, they argued over whose fault that was. As I was in my A-level year at school, and then all set to do law at uni, I went back to school about 3 days later. There was no such thing as counselling or pastoral care in those days. Plus, I went to a convent school, so no room for empathy, most definitely. On my first day back, I crumbled halfway through the day and I went home. The next day, I was summoned in front of the head nun, who berated me for having a boyfriend in my A-level year. She told me I'd be suspended if I ever walked out like that again. All while the Protestant vice head stood behind her with tears running down her face as I sobbed on that big chair in front of the head nun. What got me through was our gang. Mickey had a great bunch of mates with whom I was also very close, and we remain close to this very day. The grief we went through, unaided by any external support in those days, only our own resources and Peach Concord, bonded us in a way that I don't think will ever be broken. Mickey's family continued to be amazing with me also, and again, remain so to this day. He had a younger brother called Lawrence, and a while after the funeral, his mum asked us to take him out to help him through this nightmare. She approved us giving him a drink or two. He was maybe 15, not used to drinking, whereas we'd all learned well about that age, mainly in Lavery's back alley or having climbed the wall into Botanic Gardens for a carry-out. She trusted us to look after him. So we had a wake of our own in a mate's house, the perfect opportunity to introduce Lawrence to Carlsberg Special Brew in significant quantities and most likely a bottle or two of Buckfast. Unfortunately for Lawrence, he passed out early doors on the living room rug just as someone discovered a tin of blue Hammerite paint in a cupboard. Suffice to say, the wonderful Mary Rogers, who we sadly lost just a year ago, wasn't best pleased when her youngest son, whom she'd entrusted to us, arrived home the next day, hanging like a bat and painted blue like a smurf. It's my understanding that it took a number of weeks to get the paint off him fully. I heard getting it out of his ears was the worst bit. Mickey's wee sister, Katrina, was too young to drink then, or she quite possibly could have ended up painted another colour. Rest assured, we've made up for it since. She was in first year, while I was then in upper sixth, so she wasn't invited to our wake. She is now one of my best mates and calls me her honorary sister. Confident that if fate hadn't intervened, we'd have been formally united as a family. She's a Prosecco girl though, not Peach Concord. We may not have painted each other blue, but we've been very close to it, and it could well happen in the future. Me, Katrina, and Martin, the oldest brother charged with delivering that horrific news to me at just age 20 himself. Katrina's here tonight, are heading together to see Paul Heaton early next year. We're all bonded. Bonded together forever by that fateful night.
Siobhan, that was such a powerful piece of storytelling, so full of youth and joy and tragedy, told brilliantly. Thank you so much. Now you know, because I'm always telling you, 10 by 9 is always free. But if you'd like to help ensure our events and this podcast continue, you can help us out with a donation via Patreon. There's a link on our website, 10by9.com. As always, a big thank you to everyone who has given, whether electronically or at our live events over the years. It really helps, and we are so grateful. Okay, on to our third and final story on this podcast. She's been coming to 10by9 for about a year with great stories. This one had a few gentlemen in the audience crossing their legs. It's Miley Brennan.
Most summer camp experiences where I grew up included activities like arts and crafts, swimming in a lake, sports. My experience involved driving 7 hours to rural Appalachia, then being put on a work team of 5 to 7 teenagers with an adult, and then going out into the community to do construction projects in grueling Tennessee heat. Ever a glutton for punishment, I loved it. So much so that I decided to be on staff. Now, important to know is that the camp weeks were run entirely by college students, overseeing teenagers with power tools. No one died or was seriously injured. Well, I worked there anyway. So there I was, 20 years old, on staff at camp. Now, there were two camp locations. I had always been a camper at Cumberland Pines, but I was assigned to staff at Baker Mountain. The staff accommodation was a small house I shared with 13 others. The men and women had separate bunk bed-filled bedrooms and separate bathrooms, but to say we lived in close quarters is an understatement. We began the summer with an intensive week of training, and then we were given a free weekend before the campers arrived. Some staff members took the opportunity to go to Chattanooga or Nashville for a last taste of city life before 8 weeks of camp. I decided to stay at Baker Mountain so I could familiarize myself with the site. And that weekend, there were 5 of us in the house, 2 women and 3 men. Now, one of the men, Tyler, had fallen earlier in the week. And Tyler had a previous injury that involved a metal rod being put into his leg. So he was in a lot of pain and decided to sleep on the living room and the recliner. That Friday night, the rest of us tucked ourselves into our sleeping bags atop our bunk beds. Beth and I in the girls' room, Ben and Jake in the boys' room. Now, I'm normally a light sleeper, so the fact that I slept through the ensuing events is quite significant. From what I understand, around 2 a.m., Ben, an energetic, charismatic young man, completely healthy to this point, woke up in so much pain that he had to crawl to the bathroom to vomit. He managed to make it back out of the bathroom right when Beth was coming in from a sneaky midnight visit to her boyfriend. Seeing Ben like this, she decided he needed to go to the hospital, which was a 40-minute drive away. And this was good news because Ben was convinced he was dying. You see, all the pain was in his testicles. Men seem to believe there is a fragile tether between life and death that becomes taut to the point of snapping when they have pain in their testicles. Now, an hour and a half later, around 4 a.m., Tyler realized he was starting to develop a fever. He began calling for help, but he did it like this. "Hey guys, is anyone awake? If not, that's cool, but I think I need to go to the hospital." Eventually, he called Jake on the phone, and by 5 a.m., Tyler had also been admitted to the hospital. At 7 a.m., I awoke to Beth shaking me. "Dude, you've got to go to the hospital. I haven't slept at all, and Ben's in surgery." "I'm sorry, what?" "Ben's in surgery, and somebody needs to be there when it's over." "Why is Ben in surgery?" "His balls hurt." So I got up and I went to the hospital. Upon arrival, I went to the desk and said, "I'm here for Ben." And before she could point me in the right direction, Jake was by my side. "Oh, Miley, good. I hardly slept last night. You can be here when Tyler gets out of surgery." "What? I'm here for when Ben gets out of surgery." Apparently, Tyler had indeed developed an infection and had to have invasive surgery to fix the rod in his leg. Jake, realizing that he had to stay with Tyler, said some choice words not befitting a Christian camp counselor. And with my genuine apologies for not being able to physically exist in two places at once, I had to leave Jake with Tyler, and I followed the receptionist's directions to the waiting room for Ben. After about 20 minutes, a man came in. He was silver-haired, wearing jeans, a tucked-in salmon pink polo shirt, and a large belt buckle. In one hand, he held a polystyrene cup of coffee, the other one tucked casually in his front pocket. "You here for Ben?" "Yeah, is everything okay?" "Yes, ma'am, surgery went well. He had testicular contortion. We got him all fixed up." At my confused face, he explained, "Oh, testicular contortion is when the internal organs of the testicles get all twisted in on themselves. There's no real explainable cause, because physically twisting the outside of the testicles like this doesn't cause testicular contortion. However it happens, it is incredibly painful. It often leads to the loss of the entire testicle, or the loss of the internal organs, which may make it harder to have kids. But we managed to get everything in the right place for Ben so he won't have any issues, just some post-operation swelling and pain for a couple of weeks." I stood listening to this explanation with rapt attention, but in the back of my mind, I was thinking, I've only known Ben for a week. I don't know Ben well enough to be learning about his testicles. Am I going to be able to look him in the face and not think about the insides of his testicles twisting? And then the doctor said the most disconcerting thing yet. Yeah, here's Ben's cell phone. You better call his mom and let her know." I dutifully took the flip phone from the far too casual surgeon, went to Ben's contacts, and called his mother. She answered, and before she could say hello, I said, "Hi, Mrs. Austin. My name is Miley. I'm on staff at camp with Ben. Everything is totally okay, but you should know Ben just had surgery. It wasn't life-threatening, and he's fine." "What? What surgery?" Well, he had something called testicular contortion, but it's all taken care of now." "What is testicular contortion?" By this point, she was crying. "Well, it's when the insides of your testicles get twisted." "Oh my God, did they take Benny's testicles?" No, ma'am, the doctor said everything went really well. Am I going to be able to have grandchildren?" She was now sobbing. "Yes," I said quickly, and I don't know why, but this is verbatim what I said. "All of Ben's testicular functions are in perfect condition." She was relieved. And I eventually got off the phone, and a nurse came to tell me that Ben had woken up. So I walked in. Ben looked up at me in his post-anesthesia fog and said, "Did you hear about my balls?" "Yes," I said, "and I just got off the phone with your mom. She's really glad you're okay." "Oh man, my mom knows about my balls too?" So the next few days involved our entire staff going on rotation to visit Ben and Tyler in the hospital. Both of them were able to get back to work in some capacity by the second week of camp. And a few weeks later, I walked into our staff office and was immediately enveloped in the arms of a tall, large woman who began crying as she held me. "Thank you," she cried. "Thank you for being brave and calling me and letting me know I can still have grandchildren." Ben was standing in the corner looking surprisingly cheerful, given the context. "Hey, Miley, this is my mom. Mom, this is Miley." "I know an angel when I see one," she wept, holding me even tighter. You're welcome, Mrs. Austin. It was my pleasure." In fact, it had not been pleasurable. But it was gratifying to know that my ability to keep calm in a testicular emergency had a positive impact on the life of Mrs. Austin. Ultimately, as I think back, it is strange that a night I managed to sleep through is a night I will never forget.
Miley, thank you so much. So many laughs over someone's privates and not a rude word in sight. Well done, you. Just before we go, another snippet from the evening. Here's my summary of Miley's story and the great lost joke.
Miley knows more about testicles than most of the men in this room, and she learned it all at Christian camp. As did some of the men in here, I would imagine. That was my joke.
It wasn't really, of course, but hey, it got a laugh. And that's it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website. That's 10by9.com. The dates for 2025 will be up there, hopefully, this week. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and I'll try to get a look at Blue Sky. I promise not to flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Thanks to everyone who made this month's 10by9 happen. The wonderful Leanne and Margaret, indispensable. The lovely team at the Black Box, led by Neil on this occasion. The audience, a capacity crowd, and as warm and respectful and responsive as ever. Thank you so much, you really do make such a difference. And of course, what a talented group of storytellers. Thanks to all, of course, including those who didn't get to tell this month. But the biggest thanks this week goes to Chris Stother, Siobhan McGuigan, and Miley Brennan. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.